This show is about spoilers and discussion. It's also about spooky things that are best enjoyed after you see the movie. So any movie we talk about, we recommend you go see. You've been warned.
All right, you primitive screwheads, listen up.
What an excellent day for an exorcism.
Horror. There is no shortage of monsters to haunt our dreams.
Horror. You got red on you.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Horror.
Alive, lights alive.
Groovy.
Hey everyone, and welcome to Oh the Horror, a horror movie podcast about modern and classic films from a casual and expert's perspective. I'm the expert, Rob Holmes.
And I'm the newbie, Steve Allman. And today we've got a very, very special episode.
This one I hold so near and dear to my heart.
I think a lot of people do.
They do, yeah, they do now. Maybe not at the time when it came out, because it wasn't a box office success. We, of course, are talking about 1982's The Thing, directed by John Carpenter.
Yes, the master himself. I think I would kick this off by kind of just thinking about the broad scope of John Carpenter's career. And I think from like the late 70s to all throughout the 80s, dude was pumping out movies.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, between Assault on Precinct 13... Halloween, Escape from New York, you know,
this. And then They Live as
They
well.
Live, Prince of Darkness.
A bunch of movies.
In the early 90s, In the Mouth of Madness.
It's weird for me to contextualize what kind of movies at the time people would expect. Because, like, you would know what you can expect from, say, a Christopher Nolan movie once you see a trailer or, like, oh, he's making a new movie.
Right.
We know exactly what to expect here. It's interesting to think about living in a time when a John Carpenter movie like all of these in the 70s and 80s were coming out, because it's kind of all over the place what he does.
Yeah, he had done the Elvis film too, like the Elvis
movie.
Yeah. He was all over the place, and he was working with Kurt Russell on that too. So then that kind of started his working with Kurt on a lot of films. He had just done Escape from New York. The Thing came out of nowhere. And what's interesting about that film is that, you know, they cast, he purposely went with an all-male cast on that, because he just thought that, you know, taking place where it does in at an Antarctic research outpost 31, that it would be interesting to see the dynamic between these guys living at this outpost and everything that happens to them once the thing is introduced.
Not an infrequently explored dynamic of just men talking with men, but it is a very, I'm guessing for the time, was something that he wanted to explore, because given the location of the film and given the circumstances of which it is, not that it would have exactly, I guess, been in a wholly unique just male perspective, but
right.
It is an interesting sort of thing to just be all guys here.
Well, yeah, I think it really worked well, though, because it was a lot of, you have this camaraderie between some of them, you have some where there's animosity between them, and you can kind of tell. What was really great about this film is Carpenter had there was a lot of pre-production that went into this movie. Like, pre-production was
more so than most John Carpenter films?
More so than most films.
Oh, okay.
So they had a lot of time. Like, when they went out there and found where this was going to be, I think they filmed in Alaska. They went out there maybe 6 or 8 months beforehand, built the exterior for the outpost and everything, got everything ready to go from there, and then had to wait until it snowed. So, like, they definitely put a lot of time into doing that. Rob Bottin was working on all the special effects. He's 22 at the time.
Nuts!
Given,
to think that...
Yeah, to be put in charge of a effects team and an effects crew. And then given, like, free rein to just come up with whatever he wanted to. And he had a lot of ideas.
That's a fact where I was like, what was I doing at 22?
Right.
As a 27-year-old man, I'm just like,
and,
what?
Well, Bottin had already done a ton of stuff on top of that.
Exactly.
So, but this guy worked for like 52 weeks straight doing the effects. And the funny part about it is when there's interviews with the cast at the time when this film is being made, and Kurt Russell is talking about, you know, how it's more of a it's more of a dramatic piece about isolation and who do you trust, and can you trust, you know, these people who you've known for so long, can you actually trust any of them? And it's paranoia and fear. And he's like, yeah, there's some violence in it, but not a ton. But what they didn't realize is that most of the gore effects were done after principal photography was finished. They had like a second unit
to just film the special effects.
And they were doing this months after the film had wrapped principal. So they were filming just effects, and then they would have a stand-in stand there for any of the over-the-shoulder shots. So a lot of that stuff, it gave them a lot more freedom and a lot more time to really focus on making sure that these shots were showcased.
Interesting.
Yeah, because you're not having to work around actors as much. You're able to do this on your own time.
And now when you say second unit, John Carpenter was heading up the second unit, or this was basically he shoots the main scenes and then another team?
Second unit, but then Carpenter was there for, like, there was some second unit stuff that was happening because they were trying to pump out as much as they could.
Right.
But there was a lot of interview stuff where Carpenter was like on Botin basically being like, look, seriously, we're way past deadline on this. Botin's like, I'm gonna get it done. And he pushed himself to the limits beyond. I mean, he had to check himself in for exhaustion afterwards, and Winston had to jump in for the dog effect scene.
I can easily see that if somebody put their blood, sweat, and tears into this movie of all movies, it shows.
Oh man. And that's, you know, it's a special effects extravaganza. You don't get this from films nowadays. This is not how people make stuff anymore. And that's, to me, very tragic, because the intricacies of some of the special effects work and like the resin work and some of it, and just the realism that you get from a lot of these creature effects, absolutely outstanding.
And I think that's the sort of the flagship praise that we can put on this. But let's talk about like the actual movie parts of this movie first,
right?
Because
sure,
let's not forget that like we got some actors and solid ass script writing in here too. Kurt Russell doing the damn thing yet again.
Fucking RJ McCready, man.
Jeez.
Yeah. I mean, you have an outstanding cast that are all, other than at the time, Kurt Russell, were all pretty much like theater actors.
True.
And had a lot of classical
training.
And at
this point, Kurt Russell was basically a huge star at this point. Like
Kurt Russell had already, he was like the movie star, kind of, or up and coming movie star.
Was he having just like a couple, like a Fassbender year where he was just in a bunch of John Carpenter movies and like everybody knows his name
He had a couple of years of that, yeah, okay. where he was doing some stuff. And then some other, you know, he did the Elvis TV film and Escape from New York and a few
Big
others.
Big Trouble in Little China.
And that was after 86 around. The whole cast is just amazing. And to see that, you know, you're with a lot of these guys who all have different personality traits and different character traits, and they're all out at Outpost 31 for different reasons. Every actor had a backstory on why they did this. So, you know, when you're seeing certain people not getting along with other people there, you can tell that there's a little animosity. It was cool because they actually were able to work on these characters and create them and to give it its own feel. The character, the guy who played Windows, like came in with a pair of these glasses and was like, I want you to call me Windows from now on. And they were like, are you serious? Whatever.
Like they stick
and
to their
they
own
do,
gimmick.
But it, like, but it worked. Like, yeah. And what's funny is you have a character named Windows and a character named Mac.
Right. And so to complete coincidence, well before the actual Mac or Windows
PC thing. Yeah. But it, you know, it's little fun stuff like that. And just the fact that like certain characters like Childs and Palmer seem to get along real well. They watch their old TV shows and just sit around getting high. And, you know, there's the animosity between Clark and Childs.
True.
Because they're both kind of like the big guys, kind of like alpha male characters. So you can see that there's animosity between the two of them. And then when the paranoia starts kicking in between people, because you don't know who the thing is and you know, any one of them could be at any time. And that was the thing they talked about during the making of is, you know, Carpenter didn't even know sometimes when people became assimilated.
Right.
When he was going through it, it was like, I don't know. Are you the thing? Are you not the thing? Are you the thing?
Play it like it could be either one.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and that's a great type of thriller. And I think it, as when you speak of, like, you know, the sort of camaraderie or the way that these characters bounce off one another, I was immediately reminded of The Predator. Because that was to me the closest thing that I could kind of draw from having seeing this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And where now I can tell that, like, this is a cut above Predator, at least as far as premise and script wise, where Predator was a bit more like macho and so, like, kill the thing.
I mean,
and
yeah,
all that
we're
stuff, but...
we're also, the thing is based off a short story called Who Goes There.
Mm-hmm.
It was made into a film, A Thing from Another World, I think, in the 50s.
Yeah, that was what I had referenced it from.
That was like, they were basically fighting like a vegetable monster thing, this giant whatever. That Carpenter wanted to do with this was, you know, it can become anything, it can look like anyone, it's been everywhere. Mm-hmm. And that's where, you know, you end up with someone like Rob Bottin, who had all these designs where it was like, this is what this creature looks like, this is what this creature looks like, and it's like 50 different types of creatures, and it's like, yeah, because this is where this creature's been before, and it's picked up all these traits of all these different things that it once was.
It perfectly adapts.
And I like that, and you get to see that in the work too, like when Wilford Brimley is pulling out the guts of certain thing creatures.
Right.
And you're seeing other flora and fauna inside of it. And you're like, holy shit, and he's pulling layers away. Or when the thing is first attacked, the dogs, and you see it has like a ton of different eyes everywhere. And then it rips open to like this floral pod. Then teeth come out. Then, you know, giant arms shoot out of this thing as it lifts itself up. It's constantly changing and adapting in order to survive.
And it's amazing because in those amazing technical showcases, you actually get to see a great, not really character development, but in a weird way, world building for this creature.
Right.
Because it's showing all of these layers and peeling back all of these things and facades that this thing has adapted to become.
Right.
That it becomes fascinating to see all of these characters just kind of lose it when they actually see this damn thing. This is my, I think, problem when I start to identify horror movies that I like more and more and just call them thrillers.
Yeah.
In a weird way, because I think at the heart of most great horror films that I've seen, they have the beating heart of a thriller inside of them in some form or another.
Mm-hmm.
Where that tension and characters and setting all are the driving force for all of these great technical, like, for kills and for gore effects.
Yeah, you basically either have like your comedy horrors or your thrill rides.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's like a slow burn thriller or, you know, a fast paced thriller, you still have, you know, it's a thriller one way or another. And I think with The Thing, what makes The Thing stand out amongst a ton of other horror films, it is a technical showcase that I don't think can ever fully be replicated. And it's also another masterpiece of filmmaking between, and it's the same thing like when we talked about The Witch, whether it's the score for it is amazing. The cinematography is awesome.
Right.
The fact that the location and the themes of isolation and paranoia are great. And then finding out about like what happened at the Norwegian camp and just kind of like going there and seeing a little bit of like, holy shit,
what had happened before,
stuff had already just happened. And now it's here. And it's like, what's going to happen with these guys? And then as you go through the film, it becomes more and more hopeless. The movie is a hopeless film. And actually, there's something I didn't even realize until a few nights ago. I don't know why I never realized it. The ending.
Yes.
For The Thing. You're left with Childs and MacReady sitting there at this burnt out outpost.
Yeah.
Basically waiting to die.
Mm-hmm.
Unless someone comes and rescues them. I think in the original script, like, MacReady was going to be rescued by like a helicopter and Childs was supposed to freeze to death or something. But there's an interesting moment because they, you know, people had always asked John Carpenter, like, who's the thing at the end?
Right.
And he's like, if you can't tell, he's like, I'm tired of bringing it up, but you can tell who is or who isn't.
Yeah.
And I noticed this when I watched it again, because I was like, I'm going to watch this final moment. when MacReady is out there and he's just blown everything up, you see his breath when he's talking to Childs. Ugh. You see his breath, like, chilled mm-hmm. out. And I think his bottle wasn't J&B. I think it was a Molotov that mm-hmm. he had made. He hands it over to Childs. Childs drinks it. So, number one, that might be gasoline and not actually...
True.
The other... the actual alcohol. But then the other thing is that every time it cuts to Childs, you never see, like, frozen breath.
Yeah, you never see the puff of breath.
Every time you go back over to MacReady, you see it. Now, it could be lighting, it could just be the angle, but I think Childs is the thing.
I mean, when you're making a movie that can be as deliberate as a movie like The Thing,
yeah.
and you've taken an entire second unit of post-production just to film, especially, you have paid attention enough.
Right.
Like, there can't be anything that's not deliberate.
They want to keep it, I mean, it's yeah. some of it's still kept ambiguous, though, and, like, he's said in later interviews... You never know who the thing is at the end of it, or maybe it was left like that. But with the way it looks and the way that you see it, mm-hmm. I honestly think by the end of it, Childs is the thing.
Now, and here's the thing. Even if we never knew for sure who it was, the movie's still fantastic.
Oh, no, it's still... absolutely.
And that's kind of the beauty of it.
Yeah.
Like, the reason that the movie still works is that you don't really need to know who the thing is mm-hmm. or, like, what has happened now.
Yeah.
It's because you've been taken on this journey and it's led up to this amazing point where they're both just waiting and sitting there.
Yeah.
One knowing more about the other. Or probably not.
That fucking blood test scene.
Right?
Oh,
jeez. So good.
They get you with, like, false moments... multiple times as you go through it.
Right, and I usually hate that about a lot of thrillers, where there's too many red herrings.
Yeah.
And to be fair, this movie has quite a few, but it's about the fact that it's literally, this thing is a red herring.
Well, I mean, yeah,
it's meant to deceive you.
It's a film about, you know, as I've said multiple times, paranoia and isolation, and mm-hmm. that's... It really does drive it home because when you find out that certain characters who are dead are human, you're like, oh shit.
Like, we made a mistake.
They weren't the thing.
Yeah.
And then ones that you're not expecting, you're like, oh, or you're like, yeah, this person might be the thing. But when you find out they're the thing, it's like a different iteration of the thing each time.
Right. And I think that this movie, like, again, I keep pulling back to the Twilight Zone because it's probably one of the best sort of things that I can pull
sure.
from for great sort of science fiction and horror in
yeah.
there. This could just as easily be an episode of the Twilight Zone extrapolated to, you know,
yeah.
big
oh,
budget
no,
filmmaking.
Definitely.
Because the thing in all respects is just a device to bring out these sort of
right.
these paranoias and these fears in all of these characters. It doesn't matter what the thing can do. It's just like, oh, I think you're this. Because
right.
this is actually very indicative of an episode of The Twilight Zone where they get word of a... Like, these people at this restaurant get word of a Martian ship crashing down.
Sure.
And they can imitate humans. And it's this whole thing of trying to prove that you're not the alien.
Right.
And it's kind of this extrapolated to the sense of this... Just these men isolated at this outpost... desperate and kind of strung out on their last end just to survive.
Yeah, yeah. And what also really makes it kind of special is you don't get to see everyone's death.
No.
Some of it was due to budgetary reasons. Some of it was due to the effects not looking right.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, Knowles, when at the end of it, you kind of see him just kind of disappear as he walks off after... one of the guys who's just had his Blair's grabbed him by the face.
Right.
And, like, melted his hand into his face and started to assimilate.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that character. And Knowles goes over there. It's because he hears a noise and he's, you know, we never see him again. But he had a death scene originally written for it where there was going to be some pretty heavy effects and it just never... Whether it was time or money or a combination of both, or whether the effects didn't look that great, it got cut in a couple other ones.
True.
You know,
I mean, I certainly don't feel cheated.
No, I don't feel cheated out of it either. Like when Fuchs disappears And then you see him later, his remains, it turns out he's gone, but they had a scene where he was, like, killed and stabbed with, like, a shovel or something.
Okay.
They were going to have that where he was impaled. I think the way that they did it works better where all of a sudden he just has a charred up body.
And yeah,
they
just
find him out there. I mean, like, what the hell happened?
Yeah,
you know?
It makes sense. It works.
It ups the paranoia. It ups kind of a whodunit type thing, mm-hmm. and you're never quite sure how many people are the thing. And when you start finding out that certain ones are, you're just like, oh my god.
Now I want to move on to the score actually for this movie. Yeah. Because now John Carpenter composed this one, correct?
No, not fully. So Ennio Morricone does the score for the thing, and a lot of people always think it's John Carpenter, and he did a few things for it, but Ennio Morricone really did one hell of a
knocked
job.
It out of the park.
Yeah,
for this one.
I mean,
and we talked before about how I feel like the score should tell and not show in the way that, like, it shouldn't tell the audience how to feel in certain moments, but it should more capitalize on the emotion of a scene or of a character. And I think this score, again, is perfect for that. It sticks with its main theme, and then every single sort of variation on that theme perfectly capitalizes on what came before.
Oh yeah, when you listen to that and you're watching the film, you're just like, man, this is not gonna end well for anyone.
No, it doesn't exactly evoke the happiest of feelings.
And
you
know, and that's also why this movie didn't do well when it first came out. I think it came out like 2 weeks after E.T. had mm-hmm. come out. So everyone's riding high on Spielberg's.
Feeling good about Aliens.
Yeah, so everyone's loving Aliens, and then all of a sudden this film comes out of nowhere.
Just kind of shits on Aliens.
Well, and it got, you know, it wasn't critically praised too much when it first came out, because it was way ahead of its time. With the practical effects, way, way ahead of its time. Like when Norris, they do the paddles on Norris and his chest opens up and reveals these giant rib teeth that bite off Copper's arms, and like, the head pulls away and spider legs come out of it. I mean, people aren't going to know what the hell they're watching.
Right.
Like, when that came out,
that could be misunderstood easily.
Yeah. And then, oh my God. So there's another version of this film that is the TV version.
Oh God.
And it's on the Blu-ray, and I started to watch it a bit. All of the script notes of each character, there's, no joke, a narrator who comes on and is like, R.J. McCready, helicopter pilot, served in Vietnam, but then left and now is out here trying to find himself, or something like that.
Oh,
like,
boy. So pretty much all of the asides for each character.
All of the asides for each character, all the character description stuff, is then turned into dialogue that has a narrator who introduces everybody.
So it's like the Blade Runner cut, basically.
It kind of, and then I know that John Carpenter hates that version of it. It just doesn't like it, because it was just, you know, taken from them, and this is what they decided to do to show it to networks.
That's a very
TV.
That's a fascinating time to just like, okay, well, we need a cut of it for TV. We'll send it off to one of our studio people, and then he'll just cut together some sort of thing. And that's not really done that often. Mm-hmm. Like, you see something cut for time or content where, like, they'll just snip out a couple of scenes or something just to make it an hour and a half for TV. Yeah. But in a weird way, it'll edits like this upend the entire tone of a film.
It destroys the tone of a film. It's like Brazil's Love Conquers All cut.
Right, yeah. Like, and that's not just an ending, but the entire context of a film.
That one, the entire film basically was to show you what you could do with one film and how you can turn it into literally something completely different. Yeah.
Anyway, I think that is going to do it for us this week. Classic film. Nonetheless.
Yeah, I mean, everybody should see The Thing
at one point or another. I think it's essential viewing in general.
It's essential viewing. It's intense, and there are some really, really messed up moments in that film, but the technical showcase in it is just...
It's too, one for the ages.
It's too damn good. Yeah, and the acting, like, the characters in that are just... It's great. It is a great masterwork of John Carpenter's.
Yes, and I'd say probably one of his best. I wouldn't even know how to rank it. Probably They Live kind of at the top spot.
I mean,
for me,
for a lot of people, Halloween is at the top spot of indie filmmaking.
True.
And I think for utilizing a studio budget to its fullest and utilizing how much time he had with the studio, this is how you do it.
Yeah, for sure.
On every level, I think The Thing is his like masterwork.
I think so too. I think this is. I mean, he's of the dozens of films that he's made, this was a, like probably at his peak of his form, about here.
Yeah.
In the early mid '80s. Easily one of the best of his career, and definitely one of the best in the genre. Easy to say.
By far. I would say The Thing is in most people's top tens, if not top fives.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But, unfortunately, we will have to go, and we will see you on the next episode of Oh, the Horror. If you want to check us out more so, you can check us out on iTunes and pretty much anywhere you find podcasts. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Oh, the Horror Cast. And if you want to actually email us with some questions or suggestions for the show, feel free to email us at ohthehorrorcast@gmail.com. Thank you again so much for listening. I have been the newbie, Steve Allman.
And I'm the expert, Rob Holmes.
Horror. Look at me, Damien. It's all for you.
Horror. Come, it is time to keep your appointment with the Wicker Man.
No more room in hell. The dead